Now, Clarity from Chaos on TalkZone.com, the show that focuses on the innovative solutions to today's issues. Here's your host, Dave Campbell.
Hi, everybody. Hope the week's treating you well. Got a really good show lined up for you today. Miss Bev Flaxington will be on with us after the first break. And she's written a couple of fabulous books and it's got some really interesting things, that I think all of you listening, whether you're listening live or, whether you download it and listen to this in the future, she's going to be able to give you some insight into helping your stress and, just your general outlook on life. If you are listening live, by the way, and would like to join the show and participate, the call-in number is 1-888-463-6748. It's 1-888-GO-FOR-IT. So, been an interesting week. Last week we talked about, at the top of the show, we talked about work. And we also talked about Mike Rowe making a commercial for Walmart and partnering with Walmart. I know Sean Hannity at this point is making a big effort to try to get people back to work. I know I have a project of my own that I'm working on trying to get people in this local area back to work, get things going. But most of it, if not all of it, is just on the individuals. There's not a whole lot of help or effort from anybody else. Now, my daughter sent this to me over last weekend, and it was something that was written by Bob Lonsberry, who has a radio show in Rochester, New York. And he wrote this in rebuttal to President Obama's income equality speech that was given a couple of weeks ago. And I'm going to read it for you. I think it's really insightful. It's really powerful. And I think it's probably something that we all need to listen to. We all need to pay attention to. We all need to strive to make things better. So, it's titled Two Americas. The Democrats are right. There are two Americas. The America that works and the America that doesn't. The America that contributes and the America that doesn't. It's not the haves and the have-nots. It's the do's and the don'ts. Now, that's really important. Some people do their duty as Americans, obey the law, support themselves, contribute to society, and others don't. That's the divide in America. It's not about income inequality. It's about civic irresponsibility. It's about a political party, and I would broaden this and say it's about politics in general, that preaches hatred, greed, and victimization in order to win an elective office. And I don't think there's one particular party that has complete jurisdiction around all that, because I think they all do it. It's about a political party that loves power more than it loves country. And I think this is more about all of them, ladies and gentlemen, because I can probably tell you very, very confidently that 95% of our politicians put career over country. Now, there are a few politicians out there that put country over career, but unfortunately, some of them are junior congressmen, junior senators who have just been elected that are constantly, and you hear about it in the news, constantly fighting the established guard from both political parties to try to get anything done. So it's about a political party that loves power more than it loves country. It's not invective. That's truth. And it's about time someone said it. The politics of envy was on proud display a couple of weeks ago when President Obama pledged the rest of his term to fighting, quote, income inequality. He noted that some people make more than other people, that some people have higher incomes than others. And he said that's not just. That is the rationale of thievery. The other guy has it. You want it. Obama will take it for you. Vote Democrat. That is the philosophy that produced Detroit. It is the electoral philosophy that is destroying America. It conceals a fundamental deviation from American values and common sense. The Democrats have not empowered their followers. They have enslaved them in a culture of dependence and entitlement, of victimhood, anger, instead of ability and hope. And I would say, ladies and gentlemen, that both parties, again, are just as guilty as any one party on that particular note. The president's premise that you reduce income equality by debasing the successful seeks to deny the successful the consequences of their choices and spare the unsuccessful from the consequences of their choices. Because by and large, income variation in society is a result of different choices leading to different consequences. Those who choose wisely and responsibly have a far greater likelihood of success, while those who choose foolishly and irresponsibly have a far greater likelihood of failure. Success and failure usually manifest themselves in personal and family income. Now, I would somewhat disagree with that, because I don't believe that that's always the case. I do believe that there's that his comment on choice is probably valid, but I think it goes a little bit further than that, because if you make a poor choice, I think the problem that we have today, ladies and gentlemen, is by making a poor choice, we feel like we're married to that choice and we don't feel like we can make a different choice, that we're stuck with whatever choice that we make. And that's not the case. So you're not held captive by the choices that you make. You're held captive by believing that those choices have you captive. You choose to drop out of high school or to skip college, you are apt to have a different outcome than someone who gets a diploma and pushes on with purposeful education. You have your children out of wedlock and life is apt to take one course. You have them within a marriage and life is apt to take another course. Most often in life, our destination is determined by the course we take. My doctor, for example, makes more than I do. There is a significant income equality between us. Our lives have had an inequality of outcome, but our lives have also had an inequality of effort. While my doctor went to college and devoted his entire young adulthood to medical school and residency, I got a job in a restaurant. He made a choice, I made a choice, and our choices led us to different outcomes. His outcome pays a lot better than mine. Does that mean he cheated? And that Barack Obama needs to take away his wealth? No. It means we are both free men in a free society where free choices lead to different outcomes. And that's my point, ladies and gentlemen. Again, you're not married to a poor choice. You're not married to a good choice. Only if you believe that you're married to them are you held captive by those choices, because you can alter the choices. There is no true option for success if there is no true option for failure. And again, due to our wonderful political correctness, we have taken and tried to equalize the playing field where success and failure don't mean anything anymore. And I think, quite frankly, that we're stealing an attribute from our children, and they're not going to be the better for it. The pursuit of happiness means a whole lot less when you face the punitive hand of government if your pursuit brings you more happiness than the other guy, even if the other guy sat on his butt and did nothing. even if the other guy made a lifetime's worth of asinine and short-sighted decisions. The simple law of the harvest, as ye sow, so shall ye reap, is sometimes applied as, the harder you work, the more you get. Obama would turn that upside down. Those who achieve are to be punished as enemies of society, and those who fail are to be rewarded as wards of the state. Entitlement will replace effort, and we're already seeing that, ladies and gentlemen, and the CBO has already come out and said the new Affordable Health Care Act is going to diminish the work effort in this country, which is unfortunate. Now, he goes on to say, he and his party speak of two Americas, and their grip on power is based on using the votes of one to sap the productivity of the other. America is not divided by the differences in our outcomes. It is divided by the differences, and this is important, the differences in our efforts. It is a false philosophy to say one man's success comes about unavoidably as the result of another man's victimization. What the president offered was not a solution, but separatism. He fomented division and strife, pitted one set of Americans against another in his own political benefit. That's what socialists offer. Marxist class warfare wrapped up with a bow. Two Americas coming closer each day to proving the truth to Lincoln's maxim that a house divided against itself cannot stand. So I just kind of wanted to share that with you folks. I don't entirely agree with all of it because I think it is a little bit broad based in where they're going. Although I believe he does have some very, very, very valid points about the level of effort. I do think he misses the mark somewhat on choices, good, bad, or indifferent. But the case, the case comes right back to work and effort. And like I said last week, work is love made visible. So whatever you're doing, you should have pride in that. And Ayn Rand talked about, reason, purpose, and self-esteem. And I think we need to get back to those very, very sound principles. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, right after the break, we're going to be very, very pleased to bring on Miss Bev Flaxington. Now, Bev is a 25-year Boston-based investment industry vet. She teaches financial planning and wealth managers. She has been featured in Investor Business Daily, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Investment News and Solutions Magazine, and dozens of other media outlets. She has just written a new book, which I just love the title to, Self-Talk for a Calmer You, and was the Gold Award winner for a book she authored called Understanding Other People, The Five Secrets of Human Behavior. So if you've got some questions, if you're listening live, call into the toll-free number after the break. If not, we will certainly give you the information that you need to where you can go out and get Bev's new book. You're listening to Clarity from Chaos on Talk Zone Radio.
And now, more Clarity from Chaos on TalkZone.com. Here's Dave Campbell.
Welcome back, everybody. And as I said before the break, we are very, very pleased to welcome back Miss Bev Flaxington to the show. Hi, Bev.
Oh, how are you?
I'm just fine. We've been having a little bit of some challenges. I thought I'd lost you.
No, just a little bit of a delay on my end, but I'm really
okay.
Happy to talk to you today.
I thought maybe that global warming had gotten to you back there, you know?
Yeah. Well, truth be told, I am down in Florida and it's quite warm here.
Okay. So you're not suffering that 6 or 7 inches of global warming up in Boston. That's great.
No, I've managed to find ways to avoid it. I'm very lucky to get invited by clients to meetings, so it's worked well.
Good for you. Love the new book, the self-talk book. I've got a question for you. The note that was sent to me, and I find this interesting and a little bit puzzling, that there is a group out there that they have now called, you know, this whole thing in the winter, seasonal affective disorder cases. And obviously the stress that goes along with it. Now, when I was a kid, we worked out in inclement weather in the winter. We went to school in it. And it was this kind of like part of life. But now all of a sudden we have people suffering from this depression and I'm not quite getting it.
So I think that, you know, there's a few factors, and if we think in terms of relativity, David, you know, there was a tendency, in our youth probably to be just outside. You were interacting with people more. You know, there was no ability really to sit behind the computer screen and communicate. If you wanted to be in communication, you had to get out. You had to see people. You had to be part of the fabric. You know, now so many people are isolated and they are inside, and then the cold weather, the darkness comes, and there's, I think for many, many people, a physical reaction to this that does bring on depression. They will tend to be lethargic, so they're not, you know, just getting up, getting out, going and doing something. So it is a real disorder, and for some people it is actually debilitating, where they get to a point throughout those winter months where they're barely functional. So it really is concerning, but, you know, I look at it as interesting because, as you know, the self-talk becomes a big part of this. You know, we're not taking the steps to take care of ourselves. Instead, we're deciding, you know, we're going to live in this state. So, I think it is real for many people.
Well, I think it is too, but where I was starting to go with it, and you've already touched on it with the self-talk, is the less and less resilient we seem to be becoming. It just seems like every year we're a little bit less resilient than we were the year before. And I was just wondering about your thoughts on that.
I absolutely think that is true. I was having a discussion the other day just even about my own kids. My daughter is a senior in high school, smart person, you know, pretty savvy. But I was saying that, you know, you do see a real difference, I think, in just some of the I tend to refer to them as street smarts, where, you know, when we were that age, because we did have to do more, I think, for ourselves. You couldn't just go Google information. You couldn't just send something. You know, you really did have to kind of be out there. You had to interact with people more if you wanted information. Sometimes you had to go up to somebody and ask. You had to. There was more action on our part to learn and to gather information and to be, you know, somewhat resilient. And I think that in today's world, we have lost some of that. You know, our kids are a little more sheltered, I guess, in some ways. You know, in some ways there's so much more that's going on in the world that is dangerous to our kids, and yet in other ways they are, I think, less inclined to take steps and learn things the way that we in some ways had to when we were kids. So I see a huge difference. I teach college, and I have freshmen, sophomores, and juniors in my classes, and it's just really startling to me how many of them will still involve their parents in a discussion, the things that they don't seem to know that seem, you know, somewhat basic in many cases. So I think your observations are on target, and it is concerning because we want to be a resilient society, you know, have that cultural ability to overcome obstacles, bounce back.
And right.
Make new things.
Yeah, and the reason I bring it up, Bev, is I think, and I know this is probably not fair, but I think that lack of resiliency gets played on as far as being a manipulation tool that certain groups use. And I'm like you, I would like to see a lot more resiliency, but I tend to struggle with how to start turning the Queen Mary a little bit, because I think as parents, we probably didn't instill as much resiliency in our kids as our parents, instilled in us, and then their parents instilled in them. You know what I mean? So I'm not quite sure. And I don't want to point fingers at anybody, but what I'm trying to figure out is how do we start getting that resiliency back, you know, to where people go, well, damn, that hurt, but, you know, I'm not dead yet, so I'm still fighting. You know what I mean?
And that quote came to mind, and I wish I knew who said it. You may know, David, but necessity being the mother of invention. Right? So
yeah.
I think, you know, when we were kids, there just wasn't as much that, you know, every generation in some ways wants to be able, if they can, if they're financially and physically and emotionally able to do it, they want to give their children more than they had growing up. I think that's just kind of a natural cycle. So we'll tend to, I think, you know, give our children more. Of course, we also have access to more that we didn't have as kids.
Yeah. Right.
But I think, you know, one of the things that I've been very committed to doing in the teaching that I do and in working with people even in the corporate realm is, you know, helping them see that obstacles are there in some ways for the purpose of teaching us something, of giving us an opportunity to practice skills, of giving us that chance to figure out how do I overcome it. And, you know, there's obstacles we can control, there's some we can influence, and there's some out of our control. And I think we have a tendency to get very fixated on those things that we can't do anything about and not look over here to say, well, wait a minute, what are the steps that I could take? What are the things that I could do, or how could I influence this? And I've seen, David, where when you teach somebody that, it's a mind shift, right? It's a different way of thinking about it. And they start to say, wait a minute, so I could have an influence here? I could possibly do something? It's almost like there's a natural desire to want to do it. But I think we're not teaching it. Our schools don't teach it. You know, we teach kind of the right and wrong, fill in the right circle and you'll get the grade, as opposed to, here's a significant challenge. What would you do?
Yeah, I don't think we put the kids around a table and throw, you know, like a big bowl of Jell-O down on the table and say, make something out of this or do something with this. There is no right or wrong, but at the end of the day, all of you need to come together and you need to do something with this. We tend to, and I see it in my consultancy, Bev, where industry now is so fixated on process that they completely ignore results. You know, as long as the boxes get checked, they feel really warm and fuzzy, but at the end of the day, the project falls on its backside. So their process works, and they've implemented these processes because they don't want to have to work on the soft interpersonal skill sets that are needed to deliver results. They think processes are going to take place, replace that, and it just doesn't happen.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that a lot of times, you know, there is a real danger to one of the models that we ended up creating has what we call the human factor. And you really keyed on it, because you know, I think that in many cases, you can come and you can have, okay, here's the process we're going to put in place. Here's the model we're going to use to solve this. Here's the steps we need to take. And yet none of them really take into account that there's me in the middle of it. There's you in the middle of it. I might have,
right.
you know, a
yeah.
different level of education and training. You might have a different way of looking at something. And so we have completely lost the fact what makes these businesses run are the people. They need
right.
to, you know, understand what they're responsible for. They need to have ways that they can work together, get along together, work in a team. But we've just, I think it's, you know, it's such a struggle for so many organizations to have to, it's almost like, well, that's too much trouble, right? And yet that's the, you know, that's the lifeblood of the organization. That's what makes it work.
Well, exactly. And I think that's exactly the way that they approach it is, it's too much trouble. And I would be the first one to say, yeah, it is difficult to embrace cultural differences, educational differences, personality differences, and everything else. But they're really, by not putting the effort into capturing that, they're missing a gold mine of creativity and innovation.
And this is my dream. You know, I would love to see in our school system, you know, starting at the middle school level, at the high school level, you know, you think about, David, the things that go on today with bullying. You think about the challenges that most of these kids have in relationships. And, you know, we're not teaching this stuff at a young age. And then folks like you and I, you know, go into these organizations and we're trying to make change happen. And yet we're finding that, you know, we're having to teach folks just simply how to understand one another, how to communicate with one another,
right.
how to, right, how to come together
oh,
as
yeah.
a team.
Yeah.
And so I think that we could be doing so much more, you know, if we, because we know this is an issue. Organizations know this is an issue. And yet we don't really see we are starting to integrate any of this early enough into our school systems and where we're talking about this with kids to say, look, you know, you don't have to agree with this person. You don't even have to like this person, but you may have to work with this person someday. Let's talk about the skills you need to be able to do that.
Yeah, I know. I get beat up all the time for not excusing millennials over texting, because to me it ruins communication. If I take a step back and I embrace millennials and say texting and all of this stuff is wonderful, then I have just discounted 70 to 80% of what communication is all about, which is body language, tonal quality of your voice, and so on and so forth, and just thrown it away and end up dealing with communications on that little fine 10% piece, which is just words.
I had a situation one time, though, I mean, in fairness to the millennials, I was going to a meeting with a client of mine, a very large financial services firm, and I know the people I work with there, like them all, we've got a great relationship, but I walked into the room and there was about six of them, and all of them were probably north of 40, maybe there was a 35, 36 year old in there, but they were all, you know, on that older side, and every single one of them, you know, had head down in the BlackBerry, and so I made the joke, I said, so now I'm going to start to, you know, get a little insecure, you all talk about me to one another, you know, what is it that you can't say in the group? And, you know, it just, it brought some laughter, but it brought their attention to the fact that they were all sitting there, here's colleagues, here's things they needed to be working on, you know, all head down,
right.
scrambling to respond to these emails. So I think, you know, sometimes we just are not, we're not aware of it, and we're not thinking about the impact that that has on overall communication. And then we go back to what you started with, seasonal affect disorder. You know, this sense of isolation. Here I am in a meeting and yet no one's talking to me because everybody's looking at their screen. So we're having this movement and a bit of this tendency away from interacting with one another. You know, that kick you get when you have a great conversation or somebody gives you just a really warm smile or, you know,
right,
says something
right.
that makes your day. You know, you just can't get there by staring at a screen.
Nope, you can't. When we come back after the break, I want to talk about your article, Stuck in the Mud, because I just loved it. You're listening to Clarity from Chaos on Talk Zone Radio.
This is Clarity from Chaos on TalkZone.com with your host, Dave Campbell.
Well, welcome back, everybody. If you just joined, just tuned in, we're talking with Miss Bev Flaxington, author of Self-Talk for a Calmer You and the Gold Award winner for human behavior. Bev, I mentioned before we took the break about your article Stuck in the Mud, and I think it probably relates to what we talked about with the winter, you know, stress issues and everything else. I don't know if you're familiar with the article because you wrote it some time ago. But you make some extremely interesting points about, you know, just kind of moving forward.
Yeah.
To get yourself unstuck. And I think everybody kind of needs to pay attention to that, you know?
And because I think that there's a cycle that tends to happen if we think about it. And, you know, let's just again think about the seasonal affect disorder. It's very, very difficult right now for those of us who live in places where you just simply, you know, can't get outside some mornings. You're stuck in. But what tends to happen then is, you know, okay, well, it's too much of a hassle. I can't get out. Let me stay in. But I'm not going to, you know, but then I feel lethargic. I don't really feel like doing anything. So let me, you know, maybe just flip on the television and let me just watch the TV. I don't feel, you know, let me go lay down. I feel a little. And so the problem is, you know, we get ourselves into this cycle where it's just continuing to shut down more and more as opposed to looking and saying, well, what is a step that I can take? You know, what is something that I could do? Because the truth is, I think that we all do feel better if we feel like we're contributing something, we're doing something, we're learning something. There's some activity, there's some action. And so it really is saying, where am I stuck? Why am I stuck? And what's just one step that I could take to move myself forward?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the point, I think those are fabulous points. And I think the other point that you make in your article is about writing it down, writing, you know, taking a few minutes and closing your eyes and writing down what you think that outcome is going to look like, you know, to where you can, you've got something where you've taken it from a thought to an action, right? You've actually actioned on it.
And I love that because I'll tell you, in too many cases, we know what we don't want, David, but we don't spend the time thinking about where is it we want to go.
Right. No,
and
we don't.
Really capturing that.
No, and I don't think we spend the time, Bev, to actually define that, you know, to define what that looks like, you know, what that outcome, you know, looks like. You know, we kind of give it a cursory, you know, pat on the bottom, but we don't really spend any time kind of, you know, articulating what that 3D model looks like, you know.
And thinking about, I like to talk about the why behind the what. So in many cases, somebody might say, I hate this job. I really need a new job. So I'm going to embark on a job hunt. You know, well, why? I mean, why that particular job that you're looking at in the newspaper or you're thinking, you know, you've found online or somebody's referred you to or, you know, what is it about it that you care about? You know, what are the kind of factors that matter to you in a job? It's like many people will just want to get away from wherever it is they are and move to a new location only to find that that's not where they wanted to be any more than where they were previously. So thinking about that why behind the what and then being as clear as you can about what elements really matter to you is so important. I was having a conversation with someone here who lives here, and they were saying, you know, I bet that you're very unhappy that you have to go back to the winter, you know, because it's lovely down here. People are outside. I said, you know, it's funny. I mean, I'm loving this respite. There's no question about it. But I said, I know me, and I love spring. I just love everything about it. I love the summers in the Northeast. And so, yeah, there's a few months where I don't love snow, but I wouldn't trade it for this. You know, I wouldn't want to be here. And he said, wow, you really seem clear about what you care about. And that just struck me because I thought that's, yes, but that's really how we all want to think about things. I mean, we don't want to just kind of jump or react to something. We want to really think about what matters to me and why does it matter to me and what do I care about? So the more connected we can get to it, the more we'll keep moving towards it.
Yeah, I don't want our audience to think that this whole process is narcissistic because it's not. It's just a level of honesty that you're exhibiting with yourself, right?
Well, in fact, very importantly, it's not narcissistic because you do also want to take into account the other people. So you think about, I write a personal story one time in one of my books about this journey because I personally love public speaking. It's a lot of fun for me. I really enjoy it. I feel that I have some things to share. But when I really look at, you know, what's behind that, for me to do a lot of that would require me to be away from my family a lot, would require me to be on the road and not be with my children. And so while I'm passionate about it, I love it, it's something that really matters to me, there's a give up there that I'm not interested in making because my children are more important to me than the thrill or the, you know, engagement from doing all kinds of speaking. So I'll do a little, but I won't do the amount that I would do if I didn't have somebody else to take into account. So it's not, you know, just me and my world. It's all those things that matter to me, all those factors that are important to me, and thinking about all of them. We tend to be more narcissistic when we just make the jump somewhere because we haven't thought about all the other factors and all the other things that will be impacted.
Right. No, that's what I wanted, you know, people to understand is, you know, when we talk about, you know, articulating to yourself what these outcomes look like, you know, just don't blow past it, you know, because it is really important that you paint that wonderful painting in your mind of where you're trying to go and what it's going to look like when you get there, you know, and give it due consideration, you know. And I think the other thing that we don't do, Bev, is, and I mentioned it at the top of the show, is we get all encumbered on poor choices, thinking that we're married to a poor choice and that we have to somehow suffer the consequences in silence of a poor choice instead of making a different choice to move, you know, to move away from it.
And this is where those obstacles come into play. So if you think about it, you know, if I'd spent a little bit of time to think about what I care about and taking into account, to your point, all those factors in my life that are meaningful to me, what's important to me, and many times that's the other people in my universe. It's not just, oh, hey, I want to have this great job, but if it impacts my family, maybe I'm not as interested in that job. So, but for some people, maybe they don't, you know, their children are grown, they may be single, so they don't have the family element. So we're all different. We all have pieces that are important to us, which is why it's very hard to give advice to someone when you're not in their shoes and you don't know exactly what their life is. So each of us has to decide, for me, what are those things that are meaningful and why? And then I have to look at my obstacles. Obstacles are real. We don't want to get caught up in the ones we can't control. If I, you know, had decided, David, the most meaningful thing in the world to me was to be a runway model, and I've only made it to 5'2", there's nothing I'm going to be able to do.
No, I understand.
Out of my control, right? So
yeah.
We have to look at those things and say, okay, some things are just, I would love to be a singer. I wasn't blessed with a singing voice. It's probably something I could have worked for years to do, but not in my control that's something that doesn't come naturally. But that's okay, because I can look and say, well, wait a minute, well, what are all the other things that I am passionate about? So
right.
What we want to be able to do is get focused on those things we can control, we can influence, and start to kind of systematically work, you know, chip away at them a little bit so that we can move, you know, confidently in the direction of our dreams, right? The goals, the things that we want to accomplish. But we're doing it with that level of confidence that we know why we're doing it and we know what we hope to get when we get to that end goal.
Can you stay for a few more minutes, Bev?
Sure.
Because I want to touch on your new book, Self-Talk, because I think it's really important in it. And it marries itself up very, very nicely with an article that I wanted, that you may be familiar with already. And I wanted to discuss it because I think the whole self-talk thing is very, very important. And quite frankly, probably one of the most powerful things that people can do. They just kind of have not given it the due that, it should be, because I think that positive self-talk is extremely important, because, you know, I don't think we treat ourselves worse than we do our worst enemy sometimes. And, I think, you know, the whole concept of self-talk is extremely important. So if you don't mind, when we come back from the break, we'll talk about that.
Thank you.
You're listening to Clarity from Chaos on Talk Zone Radio.
Welcome back to Clarity from Chaos on TalkZone.com. Here's Dave Campbell.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Miss Bev Flaxington, author of Self-Talk for a Calmer You. So, Bev, first off, I think the book is great. But what I wanted to mention is a couple of years ago, there are some Russian scientists that have come together and proved that you can reprogram your DNA based on the language that you use. And I just kind of married that into the self-talk for a calmer you, and I went, you know, wow.
This is probably, I think, one of the least understood yet most powerful things that any one of us, David, can learn and use for ourselves. When the publisher called me and told me about the concept behind this book, but they really hadn't formulated how to write it, what should be in it, and they asked me, I just jumped at the opportunity because I think that this is so powerful, and yet we're so unaware of it. And that is that, you know, we go throughout our day and we tell ourselves stories about things. So most people think about self-talk as, you know, that crazy person, you know, in downtown on the bench who's, you know, yelling to some imaginary person, or they think about it maybe when, you know, they need to have a hard talk with their child or ask their boss for a raise. And so they're preparing. But, you know, we don't realize that we have this running commentary that goes on throughout our heads all the time. And so we'll look at an event and then we'll talk to ourselves about it. And I loved your comment, as sad as it is, that, you know, most of us will say things to ourselves that are so harsh and so hard, and we wouldn't dream of saying them to another human being. So think about how we're bringing ourselves down day by day by day when we're doing that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know I'm guilty of it. I'm sure everybody's guilty of it. I mean, number one, we're our own worst critics. And I truly believe that probably on a scale of 1 to 10, most of the time we're at a 15 as far as rebuking ourselves for something to the extent that, you know, our own worst enemies wouldn't even say things like what we say to ourselves. You know, it's just, it's extraordinary how we beat ourselves up over things.
And you think about the extensions of it, you know, the worry that comes about as a result. The publisher was really focused on the anxiety. You know, we really have this epidemic of anxiety amongst mm-hmm. our population, more people than ever, you know, on some kind of anti-anxiety medication, depression. So you think about this, and so many of the things that are happening to us, we're taking them in, and it's our own interpretation on it. It's the way then we say whether we're capable of dealing with it, why is this happening to me, woe is me, you know, why am I in this position? Why am I in this predicament? And, you know, and thank you for saying you do it. I do it too. We all do it. This is the thing, but it's getting to an awareness about it. You know, I say that when I love to walk my dogs. It's one of my favorite things to do. And one of the things that I will practice, I'll be walking along and just even noticing, you know, the stories I might be telling myself, the things that are coming in that are negative. And, you know, it's my opportunity. I will say, you know, this is my time. I just want to see, you know, can I get through the whole walk without having some thought that some kind of a negative voice talking to me about something. And so even with as much awareness as I have, I there's always one that creeps in. But when you start to realize you're doing it, that's when the power comes, because they start to come and I say, guess what? I don't want to talk to you.
You know? Oh, no, exactly. Yeah, I mean,
negative one.
Yeah, no, you know, and if people don't believe what we're talking about right now, I want everybody to think about when they step out of the shower and they turn and look at the mirror, what's the first thought that comes into their mind? Because, you know, it usually is not, wow, am I a beautiful person? It's usually, I'm overweight, I'm this, I'm that, I'm whatever. And that's how everybody starts their day. Instead of looking at the mirror going, I'm a unique individual with all of this wondrous stuff, you know, we don't do that. We just look in the mirror and go, oh, damn, you know.
I love it. But what a great, that's just such a wonderful scenario, because I do believe everyone listening can likely relate to that. You know, maybe there's a couple of people that are using those positive things, or they've lost a lot of weight or something, or maybe their last couple times out of the shower, it's been more positive. But for most, and this is the thing, or, you know, you think about if you, you know, you're in a situation at work and you're concerned because you're hearing rumors of cutbacks, or the company isn't doing so well, or, you know, and you think about then you're, oh my goodness, I should have kept up on my skills and what's wrong with me, and I'm going to be so stuck and I'll probably be one of the first to go. And, you know, so we don't really, and people will listen to us, David, and they'll say, well, but I'm saying that to myself because that's likely true. Or I have put on those 10 pounds, or I don't look great, or that is happening at my work. But the reality of it is, and this is the power that most of us don't want to own, is that we can filter it and talk to ourselves about it any way we choose to.
Right. It's and you use the word choice.
Yeah.
And people need to understand that word choice, and that the power of positive words is equal to the power of negative words. So, you know, if you want nothing but beauty and whatever, start using those positive words. If you want, you know, a crappy environment around you, go ahead and continue to use the negative stuff if you so choose. But if you want to change it, the Russians have already proved that you can change your DNA just by changing your language. And so I think Beverly, everybody ought to get a copy of this book. I think there ought to be like 300 million of these things out there for everybody to get a hold of and start to use.
That would really be my dream, because I really think, David, what is inside there is powerful for so many people. And even if we just started to be in awareness about some elements of it, you know, even if we just picked, you know, when I come from the shower, when I'm going into work, when I'm dealing with my spouse, when I'm dealing with my children, when I interact with family members, if we just could start to be in awareness more about just even one area and make some different changes about the way we talk to ourselves, make a different choice, it would really be so significant. And I think that overall you would see people, first of all, enjoying life better, but certainly having less anxiety and realizing, wait a minute, you know, I am in charge of what I'm saying to myself. We don't realize we are. You know, we think that we're at the mercy of whatever it is that's talking to us.
Oh, absolutely. So they can obviously go out on Amazon and get the book, right?
Yeah, the book's everywhere. Amazon, BN.com, it's at Walmart.com, eBay.
Right.
It's actually everywhere.
And if they want to contact you, they can go out to www.thehumanbehaviorcoach.com, right?
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
It has been a marvelous time, Bev. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, David.
All right. Be careful. Be well. Okay, everybody. That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Hope you got some information from it. One last parting thought, and I use this usually every week, is the individual has always had to struggle to keep from being overwhelmed by the tribe. If you try it, you will be lonely often and sometimes frightened. But remember, folks, no price is too high to pay for the privilege of owning yourself. Be well. See you next week.